Today's Taisho is on case 53 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Rokuri. Case 53 is Yakujo and a Wild Duck. Angos introduction. The universe is not veiled. All its activities lie open. Whichever way he may go, he meets no obstruction. At all times he behaves independently. His every word is devoid of egocentricity, yet still he has the power to kill others. Tell me, where did the ancient worthy come to rest? See the following. Main subject, when Ba Daishi Baso was out walking with Yakujo, he saw a wild duck fly past. Daishi said, "What is it?" Yakujo says, "It is a wild duck." Daishi said, "Where is it?" Yakujo said, "It has flown away." Daishi at last gave Yakujo's nose a sharp pinch. Yakujo cried out with pain. Daishi said, "There, how can it fly away?" Secho's verse, the wild duck. What, how, and where? Baso has seen, taught, talked, and exhausted the meaning of mountain clouds and moonlight seas, but Joe doesn't understand, has flown away. Flown away? No, he is brought back. Say, say. So this is a wonderful koan for the last day of our really excellent sesshin. Everybody has been coming into the Dokusan room and presenting wholeheartedly. It's really wonderful to see that kind of practice, and I know there are a number of people here for the first time, and I know how challenging this is, and I'm so deeply impressed that you have practiced with great faith, great doubt, and great determination. Those three pillars of Zen have been obvious in your own practice here at Sesshin. Trust in the process, great determination, and in some cases it's just beginning to take shape, but great doubt, great emptiness. So thank you for making such a wonderful effort. This is a koan that involves two very famous Zen teachers. In Japanese, Ba Daishi, or Ba Great Monk, Baso, is actually the Chinese version of that is Ma Tzu, Ma Tzu. This Ma Tzu is the ancestor, really, of all the different Zen traditions. His name means horse ancestor. And he is like a mighty mighty engine of enlightenment who really transformed Zen and made it into what we do today. Ma Tzu's student was named Wang Bo. Japanese people say Obaku. And Wang Bo became an extraordinary Zen teacher in his own right, deeply awakened and helped many people wake up. But here, Wang Bo is just a student, and he's practicing under the direction of Ma Tzu. This is Baso and Obaku. Okay. So basically, as Zen developed, it began to be a little bit more formalized because you had temples full of thousands of monks and nuns all practicing just like we're practicing here. You know, I hope and I think it's likely that someday there will be such temples here in the United States. Right now, you know, things are in an early, you know, formative state, and it must have been like that in China too at one time. In early Zen, you know, basically people practiced in a less formal way than formal koan training. People basically would talk to their teacher, the teacher would talk to them, and, you know, the teacher was constantly sort of teaching and assessing students' state of awareness. So, you know, when people are cooking in the kitchen, this morning people were preparing lunch. And there was a lot of laughter, and it's wonderful. It's one of the nice things about Sesshin is this camaraderie, right? People doing something in common that's going to benefit everybody, making lunch. And you know, some people are more expert at preparing the food than others, and they're teaching people who are less expert. And, you know, when I go in, basically I clean up the dishes and I cut some onions or make some sauce. But what I don't do is try to assess my students' state of mind, right? So I don't come up to, say, Egbert as he's cooking and try to assess his, see if he's really in samadhi or if he's just horsing around. Because I think that would be bullying, actually. And people would not want to be around me, you know, if they thought I was assessing them all the time. So I think that behavior would be totally inappropriate, and it's not my style anyway. But you know, I'm an English teacher, and I have actually had the experience of people become nervous around when I say I'm an English professor at Rutgers. People get nervous, like they have to watch out not to make any, you know, grammatical mistakes. Like, don't splitting. I'm going to jump all over them if they split an infinitive, right? Or if they, it's not between you and I. It's between you and me. You know. So I never do that, of course, because only an asshole would do that. Matsu, ancestor Ma, is not an asshole. He's a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And in those days, the strategy was to assess, right? So, you know, basically they're out in the field working. And, you know, in Southeast Asia, in, say, Thailand or Burma, the monks do no work. And this is interesting, right? Like, for a while, we had an affiliation. I had a close personal friendship with a couple people from the Sri Lankan community. And we did a few things jointly with them. They would sometimes invite me to lead meditation at their various festivals, you know. And it was interesting for me to see that, you know, the monks lived, there's a temple on Route 27. If you go from New Brunswick to Princeton, you can see the giant Buddha on Route 27. And we used to do sitting there, actually, briefly, in the evening. But, you know, the monks there don't cook. People have to bring food to them. And they now do some work. So, you know, you might see a monk in his robes, because in the Theravada tradition, they're never allowed to take off their robes. So you can't Genki Roshi used to take off his robes and go into town dressed like a civilian. But in Theravada Buddhism, that would mean leaving the Sangha. You have now resigned as a monk, and you are not a monk anymore. You wouldn't be allowed back in the temple at the end of the day. And Theravada monks don't cook. You might drive by Route 27 and see a monk in his robes mowing the lawn, but that's a modern innovation. Traditionally, those monks were not allowed to work. They don't cook. Somebody's supposed to bring them food. This is because the Buddha wanted lay people to take personal responsibility for the survival of the Sangha. So he wanted the relationship between lay people and monks and nuns to be very close. So that, basically every, in a village there might be a temple, and the lay people there would have to be thinking about providing for the monks every day. And in many cases, the monks go out and beg. In Southeast Asia, in Thailand, for example, and in Burma, they go out and beg. And people prepare food in advance for the monks. So when Buddhism went to China, it wasn't always, even though there were many powerful people and educated people who embraced it, not everybody liked Buddhism. And not everybody supported Buddhism. Buddhism said, basically, leave your family, and practice the great way. And forget about your obligations to your parents, because there's something more important than your obligations to your parents, and that is the liberation, the total transformation of the human being. And so there were definitely people in China who did not like Buddhism. And so, monks and nuns in China often had to feed themselves. If they had gone begging, no one would give them anything, see. So there was a tradition, especially in Zen, of, basically monks, taking off their robes, rolling up their sleeves, planting rice, cutting it, threshing the rice, repairing the roof. This was a Zen tradition. So basically, we're out in the fields, and Matsu, ancestor horse, and Obaku are working together, and they're maybe pulling weeds out of the vegetable garden, and a wild duck flies over, and this is ancestor horse's opportunity to see if his student is practicing the great way sincerely. So, if he had turned to Obaku and said, well, he did. He said, wild duck flies by, and he says to Obaku, what's that? And Obaku says, a wild duck. See, now that's pretty good, right? Because he could have turned to Obaku and said, what was that? And Obaku could have said, huh? What? Oh, sorry, I was thinking about dinner, right? And Obaku would know. What he's called, Basso. Basso would know that his student had a long, long way to go, right? And wasn't focused, right? So the answer, that was a wild duck, is a pretty good answer. And it takes a few days of sesshin before we can really get to that place where we can really, we can be attentive to the moment as it comes and as it goes. When most of us come to sesshin, if this little exchange happened on day one, it's very likely we might not see the wild duck. We might say, oh, what was that? Sorry, I was thinking about my job, or I was thinking about my you know, I'm kind of unhappy with my new boss, you know, and so, you know, that would be a day one of Sesshin response. And day two of Sesshin might be, you know, you might not see the duck because you just have too much pain in your legs, right? But around day three of Sesshin, it begins to become possible to see the duck. As I mentioned, you know what happens around day three of Sesshin is that you're looking at the rice, and instead of thinking rice or why do we eat rice all the time? Why don't we have something else? Why not pilaf or why not couscous? You know, instead of thinking that, your mind is 100% rice. So you look down at the rice and you become the rice. You disappear and you become the rice. And this is returning to the one, right? You know, so everything is one body, one life, right? And we imagine ourselves as separate, but when we are in deep samadhi and we go into mushin and then we look at the rice, we become the rice. It's like welcome home. This is your true home, the world, right? The rice. You know, my teacher, Genki Roshi, his Dharma brother was a man named Soen Nakagawa Roshi. And Soen Nakagawa Roshi was one of the, like, four or five best haiku poets of the 20th century. So, you know, he's widely regarded as an absolutely amazing haiku poet. And he was also the abbot of Ryutakuji Temple, where Genki was also a trainee at one time. And Genki Roshi said, he used to talk about Soen Roshi, they were good friends, but he said, you know, Soen Roshi is in samadhi a lot of the time, he said. And he said, one time at Sesshin, he was sitting across from Soen Roshi, and they were reciting sutras at mealtime. And he said Soen Roshi was looking at a bowl of rice, and he said the tears were flowing down his face. And you could say, well, what was that all about? But it's like, welcome home, you know. Everything is my true body. Everything is my true life. When my teacher used to, when my second teacher, Webb Sensei, was a student at Myoshinji, the wash basins in the bathroom are made out of a stone. And there's four characters around each of the cardinal directions on the wash basin, and the characters are I only know wholeness. I only know wholeness. Well, it takes a lot of sitting. It takes at least 3 days of good hard sitting before we begin to understand how I only know wholeness. We can say honestly, I only know wholeness. You know, you might be sitting in the zendo and your legs might be screaming, but then, you know, you get to a stable place and your mind becomes empty, and then you hear a bird and you are 100% bird in that moment. And that is returning to your home. That is returning to the one body of this world. So, being aware of the duck is a pretty good answer. And it shows that Obaku's practicing Zen sincerely. You know, when he heard the duck, he became one with the duck. You know? But there's more to the koan than this, actually, right? At that point, his teacher says, "Where is it? Where is it now?" And Yakujo says, "It has flown away." Then apparently, Daishi does not approve of his answer, because he grabs his nose and squeezes it. And Hyakujo cried out with pain. Daishi said, "There, how can he fly away? How can it fly away?" So just as I would not come into the kitchen and assess your state of awareness when you're cooking or wiping the dishes, you know, I would not squeeze your nose, right? Until you cried out in pain, right? And if anybody does that to you, you should never put up with that. Nevertheless, the point is, there's something more than just deep samadhi, right? There's something even more than the experience of unification, right? Of becoming one with. Daishi is helping his student to go even deeper in his practice. You know, one of the things you've probably noticed is that the world is really crazy, right? I mean, there are definitely people who would think it's odd to go away for 5 days and to get up at 4:30 in the morning. And if you said to somebody, if somebody didn't know anything about Zen and you said, "Well, yes, I got up at 4:30 in the morning and I sat with my legs crossed for 8 hours until my legs felt like they were going to fall off," right? They would probably take a dim view of that, you know? And they would think that was strange or crazy, right? But, you know, actually, if you look at the world, I think it's totally crazy. And people don't do any of those things. I don't have to rehearse for you how crazy the world is. But, you know, it's worth asking yourself whether what people call normal is normal or not, you know? It's worth asking yourself if what people call reality is real or not. You know, my view is that people are driven, you know, by all kinds of projections and fantasies. And they're shared fantasies, right? So it's very difficult for people to stabilize their minds. On the first day of Sesshin, I talked about how people in the information economy want to get your attention and hold your attention. They want you to crave information. And they want you to be off balance all the time. You know, when I was... I think I've mentioned this before, but when I started teaching, I was a graduate student. It was 1977. And I think at that time I was making about something like $8,000 a year. It might have been less than that. And so I had two shirts and two pair of pants and a pair of blue jeans. And in fact, I think I actually had one pair of pants. And what I did was, you know, I had two shirts that I would wear to work, to graduate school, and to teach. And I had a very nice pair of Levi's chocolate corduroys, which have gone out of style. They don't sell those anymore. But when I wanted to look good, I didn't wear my jeans. I wanted to look like a professional. I wore my corduroys. And I taught like twice a week. And then I got an evaluation from my students at the end, a course evaluation. And One student had this scathing evaluation, and she said, "He wears the same brown pants every time." And I just thought, God damn you, you know. You know, I have worked so hard. I've graded your crappy papers, you know, and I pretended your ideas are interesting, you know, when they're not, you know. And yet, you know, basically all you noticed in the goddamn class was my pants, right? But after that, I was sensitive. I think I went out and bought another pair of pants, you know, tan. I had a chocolate brown corduroy. I think I got like a light coffee-colored corduroys or something. Because I was anxious, you know. And of course, this is how our society works, right? It wants us to be anxious about, you know, like, are your pants out of style, right? I mean, I have pants that I've worn for 20 years. And, you know, I wear them to school. You know, just like I don't have, they're not corduroys anymore, they're like Dockers or something. And I have my school pants. And some of them are so old that they have like pleats in the front and they're very baggy, right? And, you know, somebody pointed out to me, like, where, you know, like those pants should be in the museum. So now I always say to Barbara, I say, are these the museum pants or can I wear these? Because you know, everybody's supposed to be tight. Your pants are supposed to be tight. Well, you know, it's bullshit, you know. I mean, I will wear the right pants, you know, because I do want to fit in. But the culture tries to create anxiety, right, about things that aren't important. In fact, I'm sure some of you know the Little Richard. You know, Little Richard was so poor that he said that actually, like, they had one pair of pants. The boys in his family had a pair of pants that they would share, right? You know, those are pants for you, right? You know, we worry about stuff that's total, as a culture and as individuals, because we live in our culture, we worry about stuff that's totally bullshit, right? And, you know, it's also true, my mother's family was from upstate New York. And during the Great Depression, my grandfather had a farm. That was how he actually survived the Great Depression. And my mother said, you know, they actually didn't have shoes in the summer. And I looked at my mother, when I was a little kid, I noticed my mother was walking around the house barefoot. And I said, "Mom, you know, your feet look very strange, you know." And she said, well, you know, she didn't quite put it this way, but her feet were deformed from wearing shoes that were too small for her, right? Hmm. So, you know, I think that puts it into perspective. You know, we worry about a lot of things that are just unimportant, and the society wants us to worry about them. You know, and we live lives that are driven by the desire for approval of others, and the others are just as neurotic as we are, if not worse, right? So I just think it's a big mistake to put too much confidence in the common sense of our fellow Americans or our fellow human beings. So I would say, you know, you exercised, something in yourself said, go to Sesshin, and you did it. And I want to say, please listen to that voice for the rest of your life. Because, you know, there is a world of, in Chinese it's called the 10,000 things, or the world of red dust. You know, we all have to live, we have to make a living in the world of red dust, right? So, you know, basically, this summer, I run this program, this freshman program, And, you know, all of a sudden the dean told me I had to basically not hire, I was planning to hire 5 more people, and the dean, I spent the whole summer interviewing people, and then the dean said, well, you know, don't do that. As it turns out, we have a budget shortfall, and I want you to raise your class sizes. So, you know, this was like at the last minute, like school starts in 2 weeks. And I had to actually cancel a bunch of classes and move students into other classes. So now their lives are going to be affected. And, you know, the thing is, you know, if you internalize this stuff, you will be unhappy all your life. You know, I have been on committees where we hire people, faculty, like junior faculty. And when I was on, I've gone to many job interviews in my life where I didn't get the job. And when I was a young person and I didn't get a job, I always walked away saying, well, I'm sure the best person got the job, and I'm not the best person. But actually, having been on the other side, I realized that's not at all true, right? It's definitely not true. You know, somebody just liked somebody, or, you know, somebody on the committee had a common interest with one of the applicants. You know, I had a friend in the Seattle Zen Center. His name was Gordon, and Gordon went to court because he was driving with an expired license and he ran a red light in Seattle. And he was waiting in court, and while he was waiting to be called up before the judge, he was reading a novelist who's gone out of style, but the novelist's name was J.P. Dunleavy. And Gordon went up and the judge said, oh, is that the new Dunleavy novel? And Gordon said, yes, it is. And the judge talked to him about Dunleavy's novels. And he finally said, all right, now don't, you won't do that again, will you? And he let him go, you know? I think I'd be have been breaking rocks or something in the penitentiary. So, you know, in the world of Red Dust, in the world of the 10,000 Things, it's kind of a madhouse. You know, people don't have values. People don't always have your well-being in mind, right? You know, the people who want to sell you apps, or the people who want you to go and check your Facebook feed, are not thinking, how can I make him a better person? They're thinking, how can I monetize his attention? And the world isn't an evil place, but people are very confused, right? And so, you know, if you play that game, you're going to be going from one, you're going to be running around with your head on fire, as the sutras say, right? You know, you're constantly going to be anxious and unhappy. If you, you know, a friend of mine is in the publishing business. And she said she was a book agent for 20 years. She's now a therapist. She left the book business. But she said, you know, in the world of authors, there's, I think she said, there's 4 different kinds of unhappy authors. Right? She said, first of all, there's the author who has a manuscript but can't find an agent. But then there's the author who found an agent, right, but doesn't think he found a good agent, right, or good enough agent. Then there's the author who found an agent and got a press, but isn't happy with the press, right? And then there's the author who got an agent, got a press, and got published, but is unhappy with the reviews, right? And she said, you know, I've yet to meet a happy author. So you know, everybody in that system is thinking, you know, basically this could be a better, somebody's getting a better deal than I am, and that woe is me, right? So this system encourages us to envy other people and to compare ourselves to other people and be competitive with other people. And it encourages us to be self-centered. And usually, you know, our self-centeredness is driven by, actually by anxiety and shame, really. You know, so when you come to Sesshin, you know, actually this world is crazy and everything is constantly in flux. You know, pants get baggy, then they get thin, you know, cleats come in and cleats go out. You know, cars used to have giant fins on them. They don't anymore, you know. Everything is changing, but there is something that does not move, that does not change, that's always here. And in Zen, we would call this your true nature. It's always here, always here. It can't be taken away from you. It can't be added to. It can't be improved. You know, this is so important. So when, you know, Daishi asked Yakujo, "What is that?" And Yakujo says, "I'm paying attention. I saw the duck come and go." That's a pretty good answer, but basically now Matsu is asking him, what doesn't come and go? What is always here now? See? And that is something that Obaku hasn't discovered yet. Wangbo hasn't discovered that yet, but he will. And when you discover that, it totally transforms your life. You know, people can live in the small mind, and that means living in the world of constant change and the 10,000 things. Or you can live in the big mind, which is always here now. And it never changes. It has no birth and it has no death. See, and it's true, you're both at once, right? You're both at once. But, you know, most people don't know about the no birth, no death. They don't know about the thing that's always here. And, you know, it takes a long time before Zen students understand this, before they meet the unchanging face to face. The unchanging face to face is in yourself. You know, but it takes a while. But, you know, the first encounter with the unchanging is actually like on day 3 of Sesshin, where your legs are screaming and you're pushing back against the pain and you're pushing back against the pain and you're pushing back against the pain. And all of a sudden, you know, if you haven't gotten there yet, you will get to it. You know, there's a place in the middle of your pain which is like the eye of a hurricane. It's absolutely motionless. I swear it's there. You know, you one day you'll be sitting on the cushion and you'll think, oh my God, this is relentless. And then all of a sudden, it's like something inside, you find in yourself this imperturbable calm, this imperturbable calm. You know, the first time I experienced that, I went into my teacher and I said, I'll never have pain again. Well, next day it was back. But I had gotten to that place. It's like in the middle of all that motion, you know, leg, back, leg, back, you know, pain, 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 pain. In the middle of all that motion, you find this place that is imperturbable, absolutely motionless. Right, and if you're watching the breath, you know the breath comes in and the breath goes out, and the breath comes in and the breath goes out. But at the end of your breath, there's something that does not move. It does not move. It's blank and dark and empty, and it does not move. Please go to that place. You know, some people don't understand this. You know, it's interesting how people can. Getting to that stillness is important. Getting to that motionless place is crucial. If you're not entering that blank, that unmoving blankness, you have to please get there. And you will meet people in the world of Zen who haven't gotten there and don't even know it exists. You know, like, it's funny, as a Zen teacher, I will have people who do everything they can not to get to that place, right? Because when you start to enter blankness and silence and stillness, there's a part of you that wants to fill it up right away with words or thoughts. You know, so I will say to students, please follow the breath, blank mind. You know, you should get to a place where your mind is blank. Your mind should be blank. And then people come in and there it's, you know, basically it's idea, 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 idea. Now, it's true if you're working with your koan, you're going to talk and things will be going on. But the foundation to Zen practice is being able to get to that place of where you are block-headed. Where you're block-headed, you have a head like wood. Between your ears, there's nothing going on. And this is the foundation of Zen practice. Please, in the remainder of the time we have left, please go to that place as often as you can. You know, when you leave Sesshin, it's going to be very difficult to get to that stillness. In fact, it will be more or less impossible to get there. That's why Sesshin is so precious and crucial. But that emptiness, that stillness, that unmoving place is the door to your liberation. Because who you are, from the Zen standpoint, who you are is that. That's who you really are. And everything else is just designed to distract you or encourage you to forget who and what you really are. It's like the scene in Ghostbusters. In Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray doesn't know what to do with his eternity, his eternal existence, right? So he dresses like a cowboy with a poncho and picks up girls and winds up throwing cards into a hat for eternity, right? You know, we waste eternity because of our ignorance. But you know, you've come to the right place. I think everybody here has gotten a little taste of who you really are. And we still have some precious hours left. You know, please take this opportunity to be fully present with the unmoving and the deathless. No birth. No death. Engo's introduction. The universe is not veiled. All its activities lie open. Whichever way he may go, he meets no obstructions. You know, there are no obstructions. We create them, but they're not real. At all times, he behaves independently. His every word is devoid of egocentricity. Yet still he has the power to kill others. In other words, to help others, to liberate others from their illusions. Tell me, where did the ancient worthy come to rest? See the following. When Ba Dai Shi was out walking with Yakujo, he saw a wild duck fly past. Dai Shi said, "What is it?" Yakujo said, "It is a wild duck." Daishi said, "Where is it?" Yakujo says, "It's just flown away." Daishi last gave Yakujo's nose a sharp pinch. Yakujo cried out in pain. Daishi said, "There, how can it fly away? Look at your own mind right now." The wild duck. What, how, and where? Basso has seen, taught, talked, and exhausted. The meaning of mountain clouds and moonlight seas, but Joe doesn't understand, has flown away, he says. flown away. No, no. He is brought back, saved, saved.